Thank you. Be seated. Well, we're interested in your argument, even as the crowd is. We're ready to hear arguments from petitioner in Croson versus Wade.
May I please support Mr. James Hartnett, Jr. will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. I'd also like to introduce Will Hartnett and Fred Hartnett, brothers and fellow lawyers who assisted me on this case from time to time. This is a very simple case, one issue essentially, but it is a very important case, not only for my client, but for me as a practicing probate lawyer in the state of Texas and for the other probate lawyers throughout the state, and I think that's reflective of the reflected in the fact that the Texas Academy of Probate and Trust Lawyers filed an amicus brief in this case. I'm going to discuss just some of the key facts.
Let me ask you one question up front, if I may. There was a severance in the trial court and probate court in this case, wasn't there?
There was.
And Chief, counting from the time of the severance, timely filed for appeal to the Court of Appeals.
Yes.
But the Court of Appeals said that she should have filed it earlier when the adjudication was made that that she was not the common law wife.
That's correct.
In all other cases, you don't have an appealable judgment until there's been a severance, do you?
I think that would be correct. Certainly in all other civil cases, the question here is whether probate cases are special.
And the only issue decided by the probate court was her entitlement to heirship as the common law wife.
That's correct.
The court held that she was not the common law wife, consequently not an heir.
That's correct.
And that took care of that matter in its entirety, did it not?
Took care of her rights as
her
an heir,
rights.
But not anyone else's right.
The court made no pretense of adjudicating anyone else's right, just eliminated her from the case with that severance. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And she had a... From the time of that severance, in any other case, the clock would have started running on her appeal.
I believe that's correct.
But the Court of Appeals said not in this case.
Yes, sir.
What? I don't understand the basis for the Court of Appeals.
Well, I don't really understand it either. I know where they're coming from, but I think it's clearly a wrong decision. The basic situation is we had a will contest. My client contested a will that someone else filed of George Brisson, and my client contended that she was the common law spouse. Thereafter, some other beneficiaries, including Mr. Shell's client, came in, and some of them filed applications for determination of heirship. The will contest was non-suited on the day of the trial. Thereafter, Mr. Shell's client filed a motion for summary judgment to determine that my client, Bonnie Croson, was not the common law spouse. Now, presumably, that summary judgment was taken up in the context of the application to determine heirship because the will contest had been non-suited. The summary judgment was granted, but no other action was taken on the heirship proceeding, and as we stand here today, the heirship proceeding is still pending. Now,
Mr. Hartnett, let me ask you, how would the amicus suggested rule change the outcome of this case? The amicus rule that until all the issues have been pled in the contested probate matter have been reduced to judgment, partial resolution of one or more will be considered interlocutory. How does that change the outcome of this case?
Well, not all of the issues in the contested matter, the heirship proceeding, were resolved. So the heirship is still pending, and until the severance was granted, the heirship would be pending. The order for summary judgment would be interlocutory.
It's for your analysis, if this court determined that the issues are not individual issues, but I mean, if this court determined that the issue involved in this case was heirship, and it simply disposed of the one issue as to the common law deal, wouldn't that produce a different result even under the rule as applied by the CA? Well, actually, the CA just kind of wrote you a letter, but as happened here, if this court determines that the substantial interest that's involved is the airship proceedings, and so this was only one of those issues resolved, that would produce a different result without ever changing the rule that governs probate proceedings.
It would.
So if this court also says, though, that it's as to individual claimants against the estate, as to whether or not all issues involved in their claim are disposed of, we come to the same result the CA reached in this case, that they didn't have jurisdiction.
That would be correct also.
Thank you.
Probate trials, probate appeals are no different than any civil trial and civil appeal.
We've indicated the contrary.
Well, the only time, Justice Heck, that they're different is when you've got cases that are all filed in the same proceeding, in the administration proceeding. In the ordinary instance, for example, in a statutory probate court in Dallas, our cases are filed in different proceedings. Each one gets a separate identifiable cause number by the use of the letters, a lettering system, A, B, C, etc. In this particular situation, though, heirship proceedings and contests to the application to probate are filed in the original estate proceeding.
We've said they're like receivership proceedings, and then when a little piece gets decided, then you ought to be able to appeal at that point.
Well,
as recently as 4 years ago.
I think actually it was the other way around. The receivership actions were like probate actions. I recall the Hudson versus FDIC case in particular, where you likened it to probate actions. But it still, we're dealing with a situation that shouldn't be any different because it's a trial. It's a contested trial, civil trial, just like any other.
Well, maybe it shouldn't, but we wrote in Houston a case which no one has cited so far. A probate order or judgment is final if it conclusively disposes of and is decisive of the issue or controverted question for which that particular part of the proceeding was brought, even if the decision was not fully and finally disposed of the entire probate proceeding. Then we went on and adopted the substantial right analysis, or referred to it positively, that a couple of the Court of Appeals had followed. Does your position in this case require us to disavow that language of a unanimous opinion 4 years ago?
I think it would either require you to disavow the language of the substantial right language, or explain exactly what you mean by a substantial right. The key to the language, and the language that you quoted comes originally from Fisher v. Williams, I believe, another Supreme Court case, is what is the controverted question for which this part of the proceeding was brought? It's the heirship, Justice Heck. It's not, is Bonnie Crossan a common law spouse? It is, in fact, the heirship. And if you look at Fisher versus Williams, in particular, the concurring opinion of Justice Walker, he discusses what is that question. And he says that question is whether or not the will should be set aside. It's not what is a ground for setting it aside. It's not who has an interest in setting it aside. That part of the proceeding and that controverted question is the will contest. And in this case, it was the heirship.
But if that were the case, then there would not be an appealable order in the case until either it was severed or the case was finally disposed of.
That's correct, and that's the way it should be.
But the language that Houston refers to contemplates a different kind of appellate procedure.
It may or it may not, because we don't know what substantial right means. Well, that's a vague
concept. It means something different than final order. Otherwise, there's no reason to say it.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think it means final order. It's just a method of determining when the order, what is final and what is not. And it may be, I could look at it, Your Honor, and say that substantial right just refers to the issue or the controverted question has to be big enough to be a substantial right or affect the substantial right.
But your argument is that what we meant by substantial right was a final judgment.
Well, I think absolutely. It has to be or else it's not appealable.
Why go to the trouble of saying substantial right if all you meant was a final judgment?
Well, I can't answer that. I don't know why the right court did what it did. Unfortunately, I think what they were trying to do was paraphrase or simplify something that the Supreme Court had said some 20 years earlier. And when that happens, unfortunately, it creates confusion. I think in looking at this, I look at this and say substantial right is so vague that it creates a trap for lawyers and a problem for the appellate courts, because who's to say what a substantial right is? I would wager that all nine of the justices on this court would differ on many occasions as to what is a substantial right. How then are lawyers and parties to know when they have an appealable order and when do they not have one?
Well, certainly when one of the parties loses all of their claims, that would be a substantial right, wouldn't it?
I agree. And that happened here. It, absolutely. We don't dispute that that's exactly what happened here.
So whatever vagueness there may be in the standard, is there much question that if it applies in this case, the order was final earlier, before it was settled?
Well, I would still take issue with it. Absolutely. I think there would be question, because there's never been any clarity as to at what point is a substantial right appealable and at what point is it not.
I thought I heard you concede that if one party lost all of that party's claims, that would be a substantial right being affected, being determined.
In my mind, Justice Heck, it would be.
But others might disagree.
An appellate court might disagree. Picture this. I think it's a substantial right, or I don't know. I have to appeal it. Well, then the appellate courts are hit with every protective appeal possible, because us lawyers out there are sitting here wondering, what is this substantial right? This is obviously different than the ordinary civil case. We're all at risk. But, you know, I've done this since I've been out of law school. This is what I've done. And I have relied on the Fisher v. Williams language from the beginning of time. And this court has considered other cases that it's denied writ on, where parties who had been denied a right to contest a will, their interest had been foreclosed by the court, were not allowed to appeal because other parties were still left in the will contest. But look, I have an analogy in my brief, or in my application for writ.
They were not allowed to appeal in the absence of a severance.
They were not allowed to appeal in the absence of a severance. But in my application, I referred to a scenario where we got an heirship much like this one, where we have the claims of 10 alleged illegitimate children. And each time, nine different occasions, summary judgments are granted, pouring out one child. Would each one be a final appealable order? Because we've got the first summary judgment. Well, then that one has to be appealed. Goes up, it's affirmed, come back, we get the second summary judgment. It goes up, comes back, we get the third one, goes up. We turn an heirship into a 10 or 15 year process
Are there any children claiming through the common law name?
No, ma'am, there are no children at all. There are none. The heirs are collateral kindred, like second cousins, third cousins, or something like that. My point in the analogy is just that there are situations where a substantial right would be resolved. Nevertheless, it's obviously not an appealable situation, because it would hamstring the probate court. Even the respondent admitted in their response to the threshold brief in the Court of Appeals that the probate court has to sit tight and cannot act on the heirship proceeding while my appeal is pending. And the reason is because the probate court's jurisdiction would necessarily interfere with the appellate court's jurisdiction.
The requirement of a severance in situations like this, and dating the period for appeal from the date of the severance, simplifies it, doesn't it? Wouldn't that establish a bright line rule that nobody has a problem with?
Absolutely, and we certainly thought it was clear. And I think in particular, for your benefit, Justice Heck, what really, I think, confirms that substantial right is a real problem is that here we were in the probate court having a severance hearing filed by the respondent in order to bring about finality and to expedite an appeal, entered by the judge in order to make it final so that it could be appealed. We had two lawyers and a judge there thinking that this would trigger an appeal. And then we get to the appellate court and we find out that's not the case.
My concern is that there's some language in Houston that is very strongly against your position. And it seems to me that your position requires at least some modification of that, if not complete disavowal. Do you disagree with that?
Well, I do believe that we do have to do away with the substantial right language, simply because it's too vague.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Keith. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jeffrey Shell will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Hartnett, briefing and staff attorneys of the court, this is a rather simple case to the extent that it requires this court to affirm the dismissal of a judgment that was entered basically setting forth that Bonnie Croson, as the common law wife, had no interest in this estate. By doing so, it adjudicated a substantial right. And as Justice Hecht has pointed out, the substantial right test is set forth in the estate of right, which is cited in our brief. And Justice Hecht stated that a probate order or judgment is final if it finally disposes of and is conclusive of the issue or controverted question for which that particular part of the proceeding was brought.
I ask you the same question I asked your opposing counsel. The substantial right standard is vague, and it can mean anything to a lot of people depending on the context you find it in. But if you have the requirement of a severance, that's clear to everybody, isn't it? Isn't that a simpler bright line rule?
What?
And in response to his argument, did I understand correctly that the severance was instigated by the respondent here?
By Mr. Wakem. That is correct.
He thought, well, hey, we need a severance so this can then go over their appeal and get this out of the case?
I think if the court looks at the respondent's brief, I think it was set forth that it was done so out of an abundance of caution. Simply because I think there is a dichotomy in the law between receivership proceedings and contested trial cases. If this was a contested trial case and you had a partial summary judgment that needed to become final, you would have to sever it out for it to become final, and then an appeal could be taken. But there is a dichotomy in the law, I think, that sets forth that receivership proceedings are different. Let me respond directly to your question about substantial right. Is it a vague test? If it is a vague test, then I would propose that this court apply the common ordinary meaning of what a substantial right is. And if a court determines that a probate matter, that a common law wife is not indeed a common law wife, that is the denial of a substantial right. And if it denies a substantial right, then that judgment became final the day the trial court signed the order. That was on March the 30th of 1993. The time frame started running at that time. By April 30th of 1993, by operations of our rules of civil procedure, a motion for new trial should have been filed.
Aren't there subsequent motions filed by Ms. Croson prior to the time of the severance?
No, sir.
There were no subsequent motions?
Well, there were motions for new trial were filed, I believe, after the after the order granting the severance was signed. And I believe the order granting severance was signed on June 1 of 1993.
I don't think it was reasonable for them to leave under the circumstances until the severance was ordered. There was not a final judgment.
Perhaps it was reasonable, Justice Gamage, but I think the question also that the Court of Appeals was presented was they were looking at this and they were saying Bonnie Croson was denied a substantial right when her claims were poured out. The summary judgment order states that all claims brought by Bonnie Croson as the common law spouse are hereby denied. So it completely took away any rights that she could proceed under.
Michelle, how do you respond to Mr. Hardin's example of a number of people making heirship claims against the estate and each one having to establish their own interest being denied, that in effect there would be a number of appeals and a number of decisions by courts kind of ad hoc as we go through this process. I think what he's addressing is if this court determines that heirship is the issue before the probate court, then as long as there is an heirship contest still out there, then any previous determinations as to other heirs would be interlocutory. Your position would be, it seems to me, that if there's a series of heirship contests going on, that as to each individual who brought an heirship claim and it was denied as to them, each one of those would be a final order, because you focus the substantial right is the one alleged by the petitioner, the claimant, and not the issues that are then before the court to be decided.
And I think that's correct, Your Honor. In short, if there are several heirship proceedings that are taking place, and one of them, say for instance, is granted, a summary judgment is granted as to that heirship proceeding, I think that is affecting a substantial right. And that, once the order is signed affecting that substantial right, then that's when your appellate timetable starts to run. I think that's the approach that this court should take.
Why would this court want to take that as the position? Why would we want to make a substantial right defined in terms of the right, in terms of all the matters claimed by a particular claimant, and not in terms of generally the issues before the court at that time?
Right. Let me respond in this fashion. I submit that the court should consider whether or not one substantial right is affected as opposed to the entire picture. I think in certain circumstances, heirship proceedings are going to have interwoven type interests that may or may not be able to be severed and become final, or that may not or may substantially affect a right, a substantial right that affects the entire heirship proceeding.
Such as the division of the estate, ultimately.
Ultimately, yes. I think there would be certain circumstances under which you can't sever or you cannot make it final, because it does affect the entire heirship. But this is not the case here. Bonnie Croson, as a common law spouse, cannot take any portion of the estate, because that's what the probate court had determined. And that was the substantial right that was affected.
I didn't understand. Are you saying that how does the fact that she's not the common law wife not affect, as you say, the general interest of how the estate's going to ultimately be divided, such that this would also not be something subject to, quote, severance by the trial court?
Okay, let me respond in this fashion. I believe in that instance, the common law spouse, if she cannot take under any portion of the estate, and I think that's what the summary judgment does here in this particular case. It just simply says, Bonnie Croson, your claims as a common law spouse are denied. You can't take as part of this estate. And that is what I think kind of does away with how the estate should be distributed. If she can't take under the estate, then there's no port. Then she was on notice of that on March 30th of 1993. That's when she should have perfected an appeal, or at least filed a motion for new trial.
I guess I was asking for why would the court have a substantial right definition that permits a separate appeal from something, as opposed to our usual severance and making a particular order final. And I thought you were saying, because in probate there's so many interwoven issues, but I heard you say that in those circumstances that wouldn't be subject to severance, therefore it would not have been an appealable order. I mean, I got the impression that's where you were leading, and I didn't...
Well, I was analogizing to the contested trial suits, that where you have a partial summary judgment that's out here, that's part of a case. Let's say, for example, a defendant settles where there is multiple defendants that are involved. They want to get out of the case and have a final judgment. Well, they file a motion for severance. At that point, the court enters an order severing that case out, and then it becomes final 30 days later, assuming no new trial is filed. My point is that in certain heirship proceedings, using Mr. Hartnett's example, where you have, say, 10 illegitimate children, some of those illegitimate children purportedly would have interwoven interests where they could be taken on in parts, not one summary judgment be granted and then have to sever it out, but you could group them together and then sever those claims out as a group. That's what I was trying to get at when I was saying that certain rights and relationships could be interwoven. I think the substantial interest test is what the court should apply here. I don't think the court should focus on the order of severance. The order of severance was a different order than the one affecting the summary judgment. The other cases that are cited with respect to Fisher versus Williams and Womble versus Atkins, both cases are out of this court in the year 1960, and they set forth the substantial interest test way back in the 60s. I think that's what the test should be applied here. The Court of Appeals was looking at this particular issue when it addressed this case, and it looked at this and said a substantial right was affected, and Bonnie Croson, you cannot recover, your claims are denied, period. And that's where the case ended. Like I say, out of an abundance of caution, a motion for severance was filed. It was granted, but the Court of Appeals, the Dallas Court of Appeals, didn't look at that. They looked more at what the summary judgment said. And the summary judgment said a substantial right is affected and the case should be dismissed. We'd ask that the order of dismissal in the Court of Appeals be affirmed. And in the event that the case requires reversal and this court decides to redefine or readdress the substantial interest test, we'd ask that if the court does so, that it apply the common, ordinary language that substantial interest, that those words mean. And even after applying that test, the Court of Appeals decision to dismiss the appeal should also be affirmed.
Hear you argue a moment ago. In some cases where substantial interest may be involved, the interest may be so entangled with other interests that it's not severable and appealable.
I think that's probably true, even in heirship proceedings.
Would it be appealable without a severance?
I think it would if a substantial interest was affected. Yes, and an order was entered affecting a substantial interest. Then that's when the appeal should be perfected from. That's when the time frame should start. To take in the example that Mr. Hartnett used.
How is one to know?
The interesting question most lawyers face most days of
that's
the week.
That's the issue that confronts us here today, whereas if you institute a requirement of severance, that issue goes out. We don't have to worry about that, and the other interest is appealable with the whole cause. I understand the desire to expedite an appellate determination of that interest, but even if it's entangled for purposes of appeal, it can be severed, can it?
Well, I think even if it were entangled and interwoven in the sense that there are so many interests that are supposedly interwoven with, say, other illegitimate children's interests, I still think that if a trial court says, we don't think you have a claim here, and they enter a summary judgment saying that, in effect, that is still the effect, it still affects a substantial interest or substantial right, and it can still become a final judgment.
You institute the severance requirement as in other causes, however.
I would
a call that the trial court would make on whether or not this one was so interwoven or entangled that it could not be severed, thus preserving the appellate review with the whole cause if they said this is not severable. They say this one's severable. You can go ahead and get an appellate determination.
Right. And I think that...
It simplifies it, doesn't it?
Well, it does to a degree, yes. I would agree with that. And I understand we're speaking hypothetically when we're talking about interwoven relationships and other rights and...
We, this court, cannot foresee, nor can you, what a trial court, what a probate court might be confronted with.
That's correct, Your Honor. But we were confronted with that issue. We thought best to file a motion for severance. We did so out of an abundance of caution, which is what our reply brief states. And that was done so the court could look at this, an appellate court, and I must emphasize this, the appellate court, the Dallas Court of Appeals, said that this was untimely, not on the motion of either party, but it did so sua sponte. It did so on its own motion. In letters to counsel, it stated, we think the appeal is untimely. Now, they must have looked at something and saw, and I think apparently it's obvious that the court looked and saw the order granting summary judgment and said that's when the appellate timetable should run. And I think the court was correct in initially determining that, and I think the court should not be faulted for managing its docket, looking at the cases that it has before it, and then saying, well, this case is untimely, we are going to dismiss it. And that's kind of a roundabout way of saying,
well, here's one we can unload, guys.
I'm sorry?
Here's one we can unload, guys.
Well, I'm not suggesting in any fashion that that's what took place here, but I'm simply saying that the court could look at this and say, here's a final judgment, it's affecting a substantial right, and that's when the appellate timetable ran. They waited 30 days. They could have filed a motion for new trial just as easily as a motion for severance. In an abundance of caution, they chose not to do so. We shouldn't be faulted for filing a motion for severance out of an abundance of caution, but at the same time, they were appealing a motion granting a summary judgment. It was their burden to perfect a record and to timely file an appeal, not the respondents.
Mr. Shell, are you a member of the Texas Academy of Probate and Trust Lawyers?
No, Your Honor, I am not.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First point I'm going to address is this idea that it was a protective motion to sever. The motion to sever doesn't say anything about it being protective. It just says specifically severance will allow cross and independent claim to be promptly closed by final judgment, and then later says it will permit a final judgment, thereby expediting an appeal. There was no precautionary motion to sever in this case. If there had been, as soon as the appeal was perfected, we would have seen a motion to dismiss from the respondents. We didn't. It was an issue that was raised by the court, and frankly, Justice Gamage was correct. It was this is one we can get rid of type approach, I believe, because the Dallas court, like almost all the other appellate courts, have got enough business to handle already, and I think appellate courts are taking a more careful look at jurisdictional matters. One of the things that we haven't addressed here are two other cases, Dussitschlager and Hinojosa, which are in my mind, dead on point here. And for the appellate court to be upheld in this case, Hinojosa and Dussitschlager are wrong. In Hinojosa, a woman filed an application for declaratory judgment that said, wait a minute, I am the common law spouse. The legally married spouse and her children filed a response that included a counterclaim saying our mother, the legitimate or legally married woman, is the surviving spouse. The court threw out the common law claim on summary judgment. The appellate court said that the appeal was not that it was not a final order and that the appeal was premature because the counterclaim by the legally married spouse and her children that she be declared to be the surviving spouse had not been addressed. In Hinojosa, the common law wife or claimant's substantial right, whatever right she had to claim, in that case had been resolved. Yet the appellate court in, I believe it was El Paso, said, no, it's still not final because you've got all these other matters left to be determined. In Dusich Slater, an illegitimate child was declared to be an heir. But the remaining aspects of the heirship proceeding had not been addressed. Some of the other potential heirs out there appealed, said, wait a minute, these people are not true heirs. And the court said, we don't have jurisdiction of this because it's an interlocutory order. The issue is not their issue as an heir. The issue is the heirship overall. And for that reason, it was interlocutory. You know, Justice Heck was raising the point that you do treat probate cases as special. And the only reason we have to do that is because of sometimes there are consolidated proceedings. But for the consolidated proceeding, there would be no reason to treat it as special. And let me give you a good example. In a statutory probate court, if I represent an executor, I could sue a bank for usury. Well, that's no different than somebody else suing a bank for usury in a district court. Well, if my executor and someone else, a testamentary trustee, both sued the bank for usury, and the executor's claim was poured out on summary judgment, but the trustee's claim was not, using Justice Heck's analogy and the substantial right test, the executor would, in that case, have to file an appeal from the date of the partial summary judgment. Whereas, if they had filed the case, if they were in Waco, and had filed the case in the McLennan County District Court, presumably that wouldn't be the case. It would be interlocutory, just like any other partial summary judgment is interlocutory. It's our position that substantial has to be viewed not in light of the person, but in light of the proceeding. In the Hudson or Houston case...
Excuse me, Counselor, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the argument in the third cause, and the court will now take another brief recess.